Great. So week four, session four, I've entitled this A Peek Behind the Curtain, which I think sort of underpromises what we're going to see here in chapters 8 through 18. Now, this is the biggest chunk of Revelation that we're going to cover in these 5 weeks. And I have on your outline kind of the big picture idea, what the book of Revelation is about. It is meant to rouse our imaginations, to inform, to ignite, to fire our imaginations, to expand our imaginations. It's meant to help us imagine big things. Here's what it's meant to help the imagination do: to inform Christians about ultimate reality and to strengthen Christians in worship, obedience, and hope. So those kind of two big ideas, informing us what the world is really like, and in light of that, helping us live worshipful, obedient, and hopeful lives. And so, excuse me, I've got on your outline these kind of the weeks where we're going. Because this is such a big chunk, we're not going to be able to go through sort of verse by verse or even paragraph by paragraph to look at it all. So we're going to talk about kind of big picture how this section of Revelation is a little different than some of the other sections, how it's meant to function, and then we're going to look at one particular section as kind of a case study of how this part of Revelation works. And there's a quotation here that actually is from last week. That it's a great quotation. I'm going to skip over that, and we are going to just start in with reading Revelation. What I want to do is orient you to this part of this section of Revelation. So open up in your Bibles, if you would, to Revelation 5. Revelation, the last book of the Bible. It shouldn't be hard to find. And what we're going to do is quick. We're going to sort of flip through these chapters together just to kind of get oriented to what's here. Because the structure of Revelation is easy at the beginning and really hard in this part. And then it gets easier again at the end. But I think that we can make a little bit of sense of it as we go. And I've included on your outline the last page that has writing on it, has kind of an outline of Revelation. I went through this week and I looked at about 6 or 8 different commentaries and other books about Revelation and compared all their different outlines just to see, like, do any of them agree on how this section of Revelation should break down? And they don't. They have a lot of different ways of doing it, a lot of different ways of thinking about it. And so I basically haven't done much more here than kind of combine sections into sort of big headings. So let's just flip through it together. If you have your Bibles open, last week we looked at chapter 4 and chapter 5. Chapter 4, we saw the throne room of God himself. And then chapter 5 goes back. It's basically the same vision with from a little bit different perspective and with more detail. And so here we see the lion, who is the lamb, and then we'll see who is the Lord of history. Remember how we saw that thing that John, that happens to John so often, where he hears one thing and then sees something else, and the seeing interprets the hearing. So he heard about the lion, and then he turned and saw the lamb that was slain, right? And so then it turns out it's this lamb who is worthy to take the scroll of history, this scroll that is sealed with 7 seals, and as the lamb begins to open the 7 seals, it describes what history is like in the time between the death and resurrection of Christ and his eventual return. Remember, so we saw in chapters 6 and 7, we saw the 4 horsemen of the apocalypse describing the kind of suffering that evil brings upon the world throughout history. So war and civil unrest and famine and death of all kinds. And then the 5th seal was the martyrdom of the saints. And the 6th seal, the big picture, a judgment and salvation. And those two ideas now, judgment and salvation, are going to be brought together again and again in this section of Revelation that we're going to look at today. And then in the 7th seal, remember silence. So sort of evoking God's rest on the 7th day of creation and signifying his authority over all things, that he is unperturbed by all the chaos and unrest of history. And so, if you have your Bible open now in chapter 8, we're just going to flip through real quick, sort of get you oriented to what's here. There are, as we already know, seven is a big deal to John, right? So we saw there was the letters to the seven churches, the seven seals, and here there are seven trumpets. And so these seven trumpets are, again, calamities that are on the world. And this is very similar to what we saw in the seven seals, and it's describing the kind of calamities that unfold in world history. But now it's a little bit different perspective, and John does this a lot. Whereas these visions unfold, we get a little different take. All of these seals, the trumpets here are of death and destruction, and it's all framed in the language of Exodus and the plagues of Exodus. And again, that for John's readers, and for us as well, if we're reading our Bibles, that is meant to bring to mind the salvation and judgment, or judgment and salvation, judgment upon the oppressors of the people of God and deliverance for the people of God. So that those themes, those twin themes of salvation and judgment, come up there again. Chapter 10 and chapter 11 are sort of an interlude where there's these descriptions of the preservation of God's people. And if we have time, we'll come back and look at that. So these two witnesses, very poetic language for the people of God. If we have time, I'll come back and explain, I hope, how that works. And then he returns to the seventh trumpet. Then 12 and 13 are this powerful and evocative picture of what we might call the unholy Trinity. And so you have the dragon, all right, in 12. With the woman and the dragon, there's the scene of the birth of Jesus and Satan's rage, the dragon depicting Satan, his rage at knowing that he's defeated and how he goes out to make war against God's people. And one of the many ways he makes war is through these two beasts that he summons. And so we had this character study back in 4 and 5. We got to see God on his throne and the lion who is the lamb. So we're introduced to sort of the overarching protagonist of the book, right? And here we're introduced to the main adversary in the book. It's the dragon and his two beasts that he uses to wage war. And so we're going to come back. That's going to be sort of the case study we're going to come back and look at in a minute, how Revelation functions here. From there, he goes on, chapter 14. There's more visions of salvation and judgment. The lamb and the 144,000. Again, we saw last week how that number refers symbolically to all God's people. And then the message of the three angels and the harvest of the earth is this very graphic and bloody scene of judgment on God's enemies. Chapters 15 and 16 now are scenes of judgment again. Before we had the seven seals describing the events of all of history. We have the seven trumpets describing in the language of the Exodus, God's wrath on his enemies. Now here in the bowls, you see God's wrath again. So now the focus has shifted even more to scene of judgment. There's very little hint of salvation here. It's really on God's judgment against his enemies. And then 17 and 18, you can just see from the headings there in your Bible, the great prostitute and the beast, and verse 18, the fall of Babylon. So we could call this sort of the rise and fall of Babylon, or I think I have there Babylon and her fate. Babylon is depicting symbolically for John and his readers in that day Rome and the empire, but also the kind of big structures of world governance and power that are against God throughout the ages. And we'll probably spend more time looking at that section next week, because 17 and 18 are really the beginning of the end. Because in 17 and 18, it takes all the characters that we've seen so far. So Jesus, the Lamb, and the dragon, and then it brings them together. And we have the prostitute Babylon, and then we have the rider on the white horse. Now it brings those together sort of in conflict, but in a way that never actually describes the actual battle, because that battle's already been won. But I'm getting ahead of myself. We'll get to that next time. I have a quotation here from Richard Bauckham on your outline that I found helpful in describing. This is from his book, The Theology of the Book of Revelation. A very interesting book. It's not actually a commentary. He doesn't go through verse by verse. He just endeavors to look at sort of a big picture what the book of Revelation is about. And he describes this passage this way, all these chapters we're looking at today. He says, the point is not to predict a sequence of events. The point is to evoke and to explore the meaning of the divine judgment which is impending on the sinful world. I think if you were to go on and read more of this passage, he's also going to describe the deliverance and salvation for God's people. And so that brings up kind of different ways of thinking about the book of Revelation. I've saved this part for here because I think there are different views that scholars have had over the centuries about how to approach the book of Revelation. And so I have these listed here. This is where I know it's kind of early on a Sunday morning for the sort of technical theological stuff, but I think it's helpful to know how people have set out to interpret the book of Revelation over the centuries. The first one we might call a preterist view. Well, not we might call it. People have called it that. So a preterist view sees the vision, particularly of chapter 4 through the first few verses of chapter 20, describing the events of the past, mostly fulfilled in the time of the early church. Some people who are really serious about this view think that all of these events are fulfilled by the time of the destruction of the temple in 70 AD, when the Romans came and crushed the uprising in Jerusalem. There's a more common form of that called partial preterists, who see it more generally in kind of the early part of the church, the first few centuries. Not a very common view today. This view was much more common very early on, which maybe is not so surprising because they thought, hey, this is spanning kind of our whole time of history, which is that time. The next view is a historicist view. This view was very common among the Reformers and the Puritans, and they thought that the visions of this whole section, middle section of Revelation, describe the chronological order of actual historical events between the death of Jesus and his eventual return. Okay, so they would take all this section and lay it out, and they would try to chart maybe where exactly are we. Maybe we've only made it as far as chapter 16 or something. And they would say, okay, there's more yet to be fulfilled, but some of that is fulfilled already. But they see it, the important thing here is a chronological sequence of actual events. Next, some people have approached this as a futurist view. The visions here of chapters 4 through 20 describe events yet to be fulfilled in the future. This is a much more common view today, where I think people will look at what's described here and think this is a description mainly of the final sort of cataclysmic battle between Christ and Satan and his people, Christ and his followers and Satan and his followers. But it sees all of this stuff as yet to be unfolded in the future. So that view is somewhat common today. The fourth view is an idealist approach. And this is basically what I've been arguing for up till now, is that this section describes events between the death of Jesus and his eventual return in ways that are cyclical and symbolic. And so this view holds that what we're looking at here is describing all of history. This is just the way things are. And there's that fancy word, recapitulation, where the idea there is that John is going back over the same material again, showing us the same image, but from different perspectives, adding detail, adding intensity each time as he goes. And if we were to go back to the first week where we talked about the genre of Revelation, this view fits really well with the view that Revelation is this particular kind of genre called apocalypse, because apocalypse is a very symbolic view, a very symbolic kind of literature that expresses its ideas in these very vivid pictures and so forth. There's also a view that has arisen in the last few decades called an eclectic view, or a modified idealist view. And I say modified idealist because people who take this eclectic view the ones I've seen have almost always started with an idealist interpretation of Revelation and then made small changes to it. And they say, well, there's certain places where things seem to be future and certain places where things seem to be past. So they're allowing for that idea, but still saying mostly this is an idealist view of Revelation. I think that has a lot to commend it because it allows us some flexibility when we come across things that seem to be obviously past or obviously future. Idealist, yeah, that's a good question. So idealist, this idealist interpretation, it's expressing the thought that the descriptions in these chapters of Revelation are putting forth sort of the ideal, not in the sense of the most desired, the way we sometimes use ideal, but ideal in the sense of this is typical. This is sort of the norm of what life is like in the time between the death and resurrection of Jesus and his eventual return. Does that help? Yep. Yeah, thank you for that clarifying question. That's good. So, there are some sort of taking this idealist view of history, of Revelation in particular, there are some features to this that make it distinctive. So there are cyclical descriptions of a linear history. So if you hear me use the word cyclical or recapitulation, it's important to remember the Bible always views history as linear, as moving a direction. So history itself is progressing from creation all the way up to God's saving work in actual history, in real time and space, culminating most significantly in the death and resurrection of Jesus Christ, and then progressing on through history until his eventual return. But in Revelation, John keeps going back around, taking laps around that same information, same course of history, adding visions from different perspectives that fill out our understanding of how that works. So highly symbolic. And there is increasing intensity to it. And so you see that particularly if you were to just read the three main sevens that are in here. So the seven seals, the seven trumpets, and the seven bowls. There is this increasing intensity. The seals sort of describe, here's the way things are. The trumpets, most of those trumpets, they say, and a third of the earth was destroyed, and a third of the creatures in the sea were killed or whatever. And then by the bowls, the third one, it's just absolute devastation, vengeance of the Lamb upon his enemies is so total that there is nothing left. It's also marked by cosmic conflict enacted on the world stage. And we're going to look at that in particular in a moment when we look at 12 and 13 to see both the reality and the power of evil, but also the sovereignty of God. These are also, this idealist approach also recognizes that, as we've talked about all along the way, that this is highly symbolic language, which is very typical of apocalyptic literature. Throughout Revelation, John is describing scenes that cannot be drawn in a sketchbook. And he is depicting events that cannot be plotted on a timeline. Okay? And so, it's fun to look at. You can investigate this. People who have attempted to apply their skills at art to Revelation. And it's fascinating. People have tried to go through and, well, what does it mean that the Lamb had seven horns or that, you know, this beast had eyes all around? And there are some really interesting drawings out there where people have tried to depict these things. And the same thing with trying to plot them on a timeline. It gets very, very complicated to try to lay this out in some chronological order. And that's because it's not meant to be drawn and it's not meant to be plotted on a chronological timeline. It's highly symbolic language. I was talking to my brother-in-law, Mike Bradshaw, as we were driving home from work yesterday. And he says, sounds like you can't dream. You can't draw it. You can only dream it. that's a good description, a good way to describe it here. And so we're going to see some of this as we go. Finally, this section is marked by the triumph of the Lamb. And throughout, we just see the victory and the conquering of the Lamb over his enemies again and again. And that shows up. So there are some very dramatic pictures here of the success of evil in the world, but never to the degree that the Lamb's victory is compromised or undermined. The Lamb wins. The Lamb is triumphant. The Lamb is victorious. And sometimes that's expressed in subtle ways, but we need to have that in our minds as we're reading through this section. I have on your outline then, considering history through John's eyes, I have three different sections. If we had time, we would go through all of these, but I think it will be, I think, most beneficial and give us an idea of sort of how this section of Revelation works to look mainly at 12 and 13 right now. So to look at this unholy trinity, because partly because if we look at this section, then we'll get to 666, and everybody always wants to know what that's all about. And so we need to talk about that. But also because this will give us kind of, we'll be able to see here the sort of typical ways that themes are expressed in Revelation. So let's look at Revelation 12:1 here. This scene is so dramatic because it begins with a dragon. This is not our normal experience in the world, seeing dragons. This is, again, just proof that this is symbolic language. This is Satan being depicted as a dragon. Let's just read these first six verses here. It says, "And a great sign appeared in heaven, a woman clothed with the sun, with the moon under her feet, and on her head a crown of 12 stars. She was pregnant and was crying out in birth pains and the agony of giving birth. And another sign appeared in heaven. Behold, a great red dragon with 7 heads and 10 horns, and on his heads 7 diadems. His tail swept down a third of the stars of heaven and cast them to the earth. And the dragon stood before the woman who was about to give birth, so that when she bore her child, he might devour it." Very vivid. "She gave birth to a male child, one who is to rule all the nations with a rod of iron. But her child was caught up to God and to his throne, and the woman fled into the wilderness, where she has a place prepared by God in which she is to be nourished for 1,260 days. Okay, this is quite a scene, isn't it? Hard to draw. Like we said, this dragon with all the heads and crowns and... But very vivid imagery, very colorful, literally very colorful language with the red dragon and so on. And it is meant to evoke something. So let's think for a few minutes together about what this means and what these images that are put together here in this vision represent. So it starts here, we have this woman, a woman clothed with the sun, with the moon under her feet, and on her head a crown of 12 stars. So heavenly bodies are in subjection to this woman. It's a strange picture, clothed with the sun and with the moon under her feet and on her head a crown of 12 stars. This is all, again, very symbolic language to depict the people of God. There are some people, I think, would want to make this specifically Israel and describe this as, well, Israel eventually then sort of Jesus arose from Israel. Obviously, the child is Jesus, and we'll get to that in a moment. But they would say, well, you know, clearly it was from Israel that Jesus came. But I think that the woman is meant to be broader than that, to represent the people of God generally, all those throughout time who have their faith in the Lord. And I think we can see that pretty clearly in chapter 12, verse 17. At the end of this scene, the dragon became furious with the woman and went off to make war on the rest of her offspring, on those who keep the commandments of God and hold to the testimony of Jesus. So this woman, whoever this woman is, well, her offspring are those who keep the commandments of God and hold to the testimony of Jesus. So if we were to limit this woman's identity just to Israel, it would be difficult to see how it makes sense that her children then are those who hold to the testimony of Jesus. This is a broader picture of these are the people of God. And so this woman is depicted as about to give birth to this son, this child, and there is, obviously, that is Jesus. In 12:5, he is caught up to the throne. And here again, we see it, the descriptions are, even though it's linear history, the descriptions are not linear, because we've already read in chapter 5 that Jesus is on the throne. And yet here, he is only just now being taken up to the throne. It raises kind of an interesting question that we'll deal with more next week, but you can even start thinking about is, when is the victory in Revelation? There's times when it sounds like it is more past tense, looking probably back to the death and resurrection of Jesus. But there's also times when it's very much future tense, when it's out in the future. And again, we'll talk more about that next week when we get into the final victory. But the reason for that is Revelation views history through one eye, if I could say it that way. Without depth perception is what I mean by that. Have you ever had one? Have you ever tried that if you covered up one eye? And having two eyes really helps us perceive depth. And so it's like John is looking at world history through one eye. And there are great, high, distant peaks, this mountain range off in the distance. And closer, there are these foothills. But to John, he doesn't see the time frame between them. It's like they're just brought together. And in John's vision, he sees these foothills and these distant mountains. They're just right up against each other. And so this history is sort of brought together. And he's very fluid and can move back and forth very quickly from things past to things present to things future. And that's it doesn't cause any problems for interpretation, because that's just how apocalypse works. And it's how the symbolic nature of apocalypse works. Now, there's this reference at the end of this to 1,260 days. And what does that mean? Again, we've seen numerous times now how the numbers in Revelation are so symbolic of things. And the number 7 is very significant. Well, here, 1,260 days is a very important number, but maybe not for the reason you would think. This deliverance of 1,260 days, we ought not think of this necessarily as the rising of the sun and the setting 1,260 times, but as a symbolic length of time. And we're going to look back now. In my Bible, it's on the same page at the beginning of chapter 11. If we were to read straight through here, 11 and 12, we're going to find a series of descriptions of time that go together. 42 months, 1,260 days, and then in chapter 12, verse 14, time, times, and half a time. Very strange way to describe some period of time. That let's start with that last one. Time, times, and half a time is a reference back to Daniel 7:25. And Revelation has a lot in common with the second half of Daniel. Most of us read the book of Daniel. I think we're very comfortable in the first half of Daniel because, you know, you've got those stories that we all grew up with and love from our days in Sunday school as a kid. You know, you've got Daniel in the lion's den, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego in the fiery furnace. You know, Daniel and the three friends kind of standing strong against the emperor and not eating his food and that sort of thing. But the second half of Daniel just shifts very abruptly into this sort of the same kind of apocalyptic imagery, and Revelation uses it a lot. And so this reference to time, times, and half a time for Daniel means a year. And so he is talking time, so time, times, now two more times, and half a time, he's talking about 3.5 years. 42 months. Also, think about just 36 plus 6, 42, 3.5 years, 1,260 days. In the ancient world, a month, a calendar month was 30 days. A calendar year was 360 days. You do the math on either of those, 1,260 days is 3.5 years. And so this very significant, this 3.5 year time span. Now, so you see that in 11:2, 11:3, those are brought together. 42. I hope I'm not boring you with numbers, but the symbology of this is really important for John. He says, Look at verse 1. Then I was given a measuring rod like a staff, and I was told, rise and measure the temple of God and the altar and those who worship there. So what he's doing there is he is measuring in the Bible. Remember at the end of Ezekiel 40 through 48. In that case, it's not Ezekiel. Ezekiel watches as an angel measures the temple. But measuring has to do with marking as authentic and marking ownership and preservation, right? So he is saying the temple of God and the altar and those who worship there. So he's marking out salvation, preservation for those who are God's people. And but do not measure the court outside the temple. Leave that out, for it is given over to the nations, and they will trample the holy city for 42 months. So he's saying there is both here salvation and judgment. Those, God's people, will be preserved. But those who are in the holy city but not part of God's people, those who claim to be Christians and are not, those who are not genuine, they will be trampled for 42 months. Now this number 42, I think he uses 42 first before he gets to time, times, and half a time, or 1260, because that number is significant. It doesn't mean much to us. As you read through the Bible, I can't think of a time where the number 42 shows up, but it does, sort of, in Numbers 33. And in Numbers 33, this is one of those chapters, if I'm just reading through my Bible, I kind of skip over, because it's a list of all the places that Israel encamped, all the places they camped out between being led out of Egypt and their eventual return into the entrance into the Promised Land. So we read that now. It's just this list of places that we've never heard of, hard to find on a map, but there's 42 of them. So in those years between Israel being delivered from slavery in Egypt and being eventually allowed into the Promised Land, they stopped in 42 different places. So that number then is significant. It depicts this time frame between deliverance from bondage and ultimate deliverance into the Promised Land. And so, again, it's just this map of, okay, this is world history. He's saying in this time frame between the death and resurrection of Christ and his eventual return, you have this, that 42 number becomes significant for that. And then he, maybe, I don't know why, nobody really has a clear picture. Why does he then shift gears to 1260, to 3.5 years? Maybe it's just artistic. But he uses them, 42 refers to God's judgment. He uses the 1260 to refer to God's salvation. And he says, I will grant authority to my two witnesses, and they will prophesy for 1,260 days, clothed in sackcloth. And then he goes on to describe these two olive trees. And that chapter is descriptive of Elijah and Moses. And so you have there sort of descriptive of the Word of God throughout the Old Testament. There are references, Elijah and Moses sort of sum up the teaching of the Old Testament in both the law and the prophets. And so it's in Mark chapter 9, it's Elijah and Moses, remember, who appear in the transfiguration. They're there to give their own testimony to Jesus. So this is describing God's preservation and salvation of his people. And then you see them again work the other way, 12:6 here. So there is again preservation of God's people. And we see that because he uses the 1260 days again. But then in 13:5, there's another reference to the 42 months. And in that case, it's again a description of opposition and God's judgment. So we see that real symbology of it. Verses 7 through 9 describe a war. And so we come out of this vision of the woman and the dragon. And now war arose in heaven. Michael and his angels fighting against the dragon. He doesn't tell us much more about Michael, this angel. Angels figure very significantly in the book of Revelation, but not many of them are named. And so this Michael must be very prominent in that throughout history, people have taken Michael to be this sort of archangel who is chief of angels. Whoever he is powerful enough to wage war against the dragon. along with his angels. And then you see, and the dragon and his angels fought back, but he was defeated. And there was no longer any place for them in heaven. And so they are cast down. The great dragon was thrown down, and the ancient serpent, who is called the devil and Satan, the deceiver of the whole world, he was thrown down to the earth, and his angels were thrown down with him. I think this is probably a reference to the death and resurrection of Jesus. That this, exactly how that plays out with this angelic war between Michael and these angels is hard to say. But, and it raises that same question we'll deal with next time about where exactly does the victory take place? When does the victory take place? And we'll talk more about that, especially when we look at chapter 20, when the beast is chained and the dragon is chained and thrown into the pit and so on. But the point is of all this is that, again, we see the triumph of the Lamb. That in this case, it's not even the Lamb himself who has to fight. His lieutenant, Michael, this great angel, is leading this battle, casting Satan down from heaven. Now, Michael doesn't finally vanquish him. That's something only the Lamb can do, and we'll see that more next week. So this dragon, I'm going to skip down now for time to chapter 13, because this dragon wages war. We'll back up just a little bit in verse 17 of chapter 12. Then the dragon became furious with the woman and went off to make war on the rest of her offspring, on those who keep the commandments of God and hold to the testimony of Jesus. And he stood on the sand of the sea. And that prepares what's about this vision that's about to happen. So whatever else we understand of this, we know this dragon hates the Lamb. Hates the woman and hates the woman's child and hates the offspring, those who follow Jesus, and wages war against them. And so what comes next, chapter 13 then, this vision of two beasts is a description of how the dragon wages war. And so there are two beasts that come, and we're going to read through a little bit of this, but they have two different modes of warfare against the people of God. The first one is a very cruel and tyrannical beast who wages war by oppression. The second one is a smooth-talking, seductive beast who wages war by assimilation. And so we're going to see that a little bit as they go, as we go. The first beast comes out of the sea. Look at verse 13:1. I saw a beast rising out of the sea with 10 horns and 7 heads, with 10 diadems on its horns and blasphemous names on its heads. And so, this is, again, hard to draw, but very descriptive. 7, 10, very significant numbers. One of the things we'll notice in this is, if you have time this week, come back and read chapters 12 and 13 and ask the question, where do the dragon and the beasts mimic the Lamb? And there's significant ways where the dragon and the beasts try to imitate the Lamb as a means of coercion and persuasion. And so, having the 7 heads, he's mimicking the dragon. But the 10 horns, remember we saw that on the Lamb had 10 horns, symbolizing power and authority. This is a gruesome picture if we keep going. The beast that I saw was like a leopard. Its feet were like a bear's. Its mouth was like a lion's mouth. And to it the dragon gave his power and his throne and great authority. One of the heads seemed to have a mortal wound, but its mortal wound was healed, and the whole earth marveled as they followed the beast, and they worshipped the dragon, for he had given his authority to the beast, and they worshipped the beast, saying, "Who is like the beast? Who can fight against it?" And so you have here this beast that is powerful and has great authority. And did you notice how he imitates the Lamb? He had received a mortal wound, and the mortal wound had been healed. Now, that's a flimsy counterfeit, because the Lamb was slain. The Lamb had been slain, was dead, and is now alive. This mortal wound, this beast never died and came back to life. It had a mortal wound. It had a wound unto death, is the literal way we might say that. But it appears to have been healed. Now, this probably, for John and his readers, does have some historical reference to the Roman Empire. If you're not very familiar with the Roman history, that's okay. But all you really need to know for this is that there was this emperor named Nero who was a very bad guy. And the Senate and others opposed him for his, he was crazy. They opposed him for his tyranny. They went to arrest him and depose him as emperor. He heard that they were coming. He killed himself. And on the heels of that, in the mid-60s, the empire is thrown into turmoil. And it took several decades to sort of regain stability and authority over the empire. And so this could be a reference, this mortal wound could be a reference to the death of Nero, the instability of the Roman Empire as it almost totters into chaos and anarchy, and then the eventual sort of restabilization through subsequent Caesars. There was also a legend around this time in the late 90s. There was this legend that sort of kept popping up about the return of Nero. In Latin, they called it Neros Redivivus. You don't have to know Latin to sort of see Nero reborn or alive again. And so there was this fear that Nero was going to return because the circumstances of his death were kind of shady and what happened to his body. And so there's this fear that Nero was going to come back and reassert control. And so that whole fear of tyranny and oppression fits right in with how this beast works. And so it is just a caricature and a counterfeit of God and his ways and how God rules his people. And then we saw, look at verse 8. You see the 7 and 8. You see the scope of his tyranny and oppression. It was allowed to make war on the saints and to conquer them. And authority was given it over every tribe and people and language and nation. And all those who dwell on the earth will worship it. Everyone whose name has not been written before the foundation of the world in the book of life of the Lamb that was slain. And so there is just this scope of following the beast is global. And all who do not follow the Lamb follow the beast. And this beast may represent world powers of all kinds. Since then, you think about how empires have risen. Babylon, even though it happened long before John was writing, is a frequent reference point for worldwide oppression. And then, of course, Rome. And throughout world history, there have been other empires and kings and nations that have exercised worldwide domination in different forms. Sometimes military might, sometimes economic and cultural exercise. But that actually kind of leads us then into the second beast. The second beast, another beast rising out of the earth. The first rose out of the sea, which is the sea in most parts of Scripture is symbolic for chaos and disorder. But this one rises out of the earth. It's the same way that man was created way back in Genesis, out of the dust of the earth. It had two horns like a lamb, and it spoke like a dragon. So at first it looks appealing, and it speaks like a dragon. I think the idea there is not necessarily that it roars in some fearsome way, but is seductive. And we see that as it goes. It exercises all the authority of the first beast in its presence and makes the earth and its inhabitants worship the first beast whose mortal wound was healed. It performs great signs, even making fire come down from heaven to earth in front of the people. And so this is, we can keep going. And by the signs that it is allowed to work in the presence of the beast, it deceives. That's very important. So this is not ruling by oppression like the first beast. It's ruling by deception and seduction. It deceives those who dwell on the earth, telling them to make an image for the beast that was wounded by the sword and yet lived. And it was allowed to give breath to the image of the beast so that the image of the beast might even speak and might cause those who would not worship the image of the beast to be slain. And then listen to this sort of economic oppression that it... Because think now about the part that we're about to read. Think about even in our culture the push for conformity on controversial cultural issues. Now listen to this. Also, it causes all, both small and great, both rich and poor, both free and slave, to be marked on the right hand or the forehead, so that no one can buy or sell unless he has the mark, that is, the name of the beast or the number of its name. This calls for wisdom. Let the one who has understanding calculate the number of the beast, for it is the number of a man, and his number is 666. Okay, so that brings us to this big question. What does this mean, this mark? There have been some really creative attempts to explain this in the course of world history. There was a very small group of people who, around 1980, thought that this must refer to Ronald Wilson Reagan, because each of his names had six letters. It's got to be, right? So there have been other equally creative and less successful descriptions of what this must refer to. But I'm going to give you another fancy theological term for this. In the ancient world, there was a practice called gematria. G-E-M-A-T-R-I-A, gematria. It actually comes from the same Greek word where we get the English word geometry. And it had to do with calculating numbers, using numbers to figure stuff out. And it was common, but so people have used a lot of complicated ways of explaining using sort of this gematria approach, this using numbers to calculate who is this 666? Who does this refer to? It helps us, I think, that John says it is the number of a man. Our English translation of that makes it sound sort of like this is referring to a specific individual. It's probably better to think of this as 666, it is calculated using human calculations, using human methods of numbering. It's the same phrase that comes up later when the angel has John measure the holy city in chapter 21, and he says, I measured it using the measurement of a man, meaning the measurement of just human measurement. And I think what he's telling us in that is that this is supposed to be something that anybody could understand. There's a long-standing interpretation that takes this as referring to Nero, who we talked about before. And the idea there, there's a really complicated way of getting there. If you take, in the ancient world, they didn't have numbers the way we have numbers. I think even about Roman numerals, right? They used letters to signify numbers. That was true in ancient Latin, in Greek, and in Hebrew. So you could take the name Nero Caesar and translate it into Hebrew and then convert those letters into their sort of number equivalents and add it up, and you end up with 666. Would John's readers have known to do that right off the bat? Would they have? Most of them were not Hebrew speakers because they lived in Turkey. They were Greek speakers. Even if there were Jews in the area, they probably spoke Aramaic rather than Hebrew. It's very complicated. Would they have? Maybe. Yeah, maybe. Maybe they would. I don't know. It's hard to sustain that that's what's going on. I think it's better to see, as we've talked about, the perfection of the number 7. I think a much simpler and easier way to resolve this is to think about how the number 6 falls short of the number 7. If the number 7 is this symbol of divine perfection that keeps emerging over and over again in the book of Revelation, then the number 6 that falls short of 7 indicates, I think, the sinful and evil that is less than God's perfect divinity that's communicated in 7. And so then to have it 3 times, that was just how you did emphasis in the old world. Holy, holy, holy. You know, you can't underline stuff. You don't have bold font. They don't do emoticons. If you want to get the point across, you say it 2 times. If you really want to get the point across, you say it 3 times. 666. How evil is it? It is perfectly evil. It is a trinity of evil. That is, I think, what this number is meant to signify. So it may be applied then easily to any world system or world leader who aligns themselves throughout history against the Lamb and against his people. 666, is it the number of Adolf Hitler? Yeah, absolutely. Is it the number of, fill in the blank with any, whether it be political and governmental, social, cultural influences that are arrayed against Christ and his people and righteousness? Yes, it applies to them. And so I didn't get this quotation in your outline, but there's a commentator named Stephen Smalley, and he says it's a generic symbol for humanistic and indeed idolatrous trinity. He said, John is not here referring in the first place to individual and historical tyrants. He is speaking of varied types of authority which use power wrongly. so as to induce doctrinal error and ethical compromise. Romans 12 and 13 together set before John's audience the ultimate conflict between good and evil, which is highlighted in the symbolism of the cryptogram 666. Now the stage is set for the final encounter between the forces of right and wrong. I think that's a helpful way to understand what's going on here. And we'll have that quotation on the outline that we post online this week if you want to read that. Now, I don't want to just stop and leave you here, because this is a bleak and dark description of the way the world is right now, isn't it? This power and pervasity of evil at all levels of government and society throughout history. But remember how John hears and sees. Let's go one more verse. Revelation 14:1. So he has heard the number. He has heard this. He's had this vision. Now, then I looked, and behold, on Mount Zion stood the Lamb, and with him 144,000 who had his name on his father and his father's name written on their foreheads. That number 666, remember how it was on the forehead and the hand of the followers? It's not a tattoo. You don't have to be scared of things like the government's not going to make you get it tattooed on your forehead. It symbolizes the thoughts and the actions of all people, right? That's exactly, go back to Deuteronomy 6:4, when Jesus said, teach your children, keep them, write them on your hands, keep them as a frontlet on your forehead. He is talking about have the words of God in your thoughts and in your actions. It's the same thing. Well, these people have evil, 666, their thoughts and actions. But here we see they have the name of the Lamb and his Father's name written on their foreheads. And I think he means us to understand on their hands as well. And so there's this, we could keep reading, and I hope you will this week, just to keep reading, because Revelation just keeps oscillating between this picture of real and powerful evil in the world, but triumph and victory in the Lamb. And so throughout this section, as we go back and forth, we see these two things arrayed. Evil is real and it is powerful. And there is this tension that is building throughout this section, that the further into these chapters we go, the more we feel the real and the radical power of evil and long for deliverance in the Lamb. And we get hints of it. It's going to come, but it hasn't come yet. It's building our anticipation for what is to come and what we're going to see next week. And so I'm going to finish with this quotation from G.K. Beale, who's a commentator, a theologian. He writes, "The sovereignty of God and Christ in redeeming and judging brings them, God and Christ, glory, which is intended to motivate saints to worship God and to reflect His glorious attributes through obedience to His Word." So there we have again, even in these dark passages of Revelation, God is intending this to motivate us to worship the Lamb, to obey, and to hope in His final victory. So that is a lot to think about from these chapters here. Thank you for coming this morning and listening. Now we have the privilege of going to worship and to hear preaching. So sorry to keep you a little bit late, but we will finish here and we'll be back again if you have time between now and next week. And you can read chapters, say, 19 to 22. That's great. If you can't read that much, read 21 and 22. If you can't read that much, just read 22. It'll be great. We're going to see. Look at all that next week. We'll see you then. Thanks so much.